Welcome to Malden Reads One City, One Book, the companion podcast to the community reading program in Malden, Massachusetts. This year's book is Born a Crime by the famous comedian Trevor Noah. I'm your host, Annie Bennett. Let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Malden Reads One City, One Book. I'm your host, Annie Bennett. Here today we have Guillermo Hamlin. How are you doing today, Guillermo?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to get started. So tell me about your work with Urban Media Arts as the Government Affairs Coordinator.
Thank you. So my work in Government Affairs Coordinating with Urban Media Arts began when I was first hired here back when it was Malden Access Television. It was a great opportunity. Executive Director Ron Cox suggested that I fill the role. And after some consideration, I went on to pursue the role. And the role in itself deals with overseeing the cable programming, working with the James Mudge, the Director of Production and Programming, to consider government access programs, largely city council meetings, school committee meetings, the planning board, and Board of Appeals.
So you primarily focus on Urban Media Arts' coverage of different political events?
I think the key word I would use is government. City government, city services, stuff that is political, for instance, such as political forums. Campaign season, the election season, is when the government becomes political.
Interesting.
Okay. And then that's when I and we tend to do our best to be a neutral arbiter for what is being advocated by the candidates, what is being advocated by the residents, and then we do our best to be as accessible as possible to get that word out there.
Right. And I know that this also includes some collaboration with different civic organizations in the area and also different businesses. Can you tell me about that outreach initiative and how you go about connecting the community?
Most certainly. So part of my role, in addition to being the Government Affairs Coordinator, is I work with the Executive Director in our mutual mission to work with the Malden Chamber of Commerce. Both the Executive Director and I are members of the Malden Rotary Club. We work hard to make sure that our outreach to the city is also done through the professional groups, businesses, and community organizations, because they're really the movers of the city. They hold events, they hold forums, they have membership. And these people really do get the ball rolling in the city of Malden. And we want to be as inclusive as possible in bringing their voices in, because the truth of the matter is that they were also a big part of what has made MATV, now Urban Media Arts, a big success, is the fact that we have always been in the community. We've been an amplifier of the community, and they've appreciated that for us.
And for our listeners who may not know, can you explain what a Rotary Club does?
Most certainly. So the Rotary Club is a civic organization that is a volunteer effort. And in short, they volunteer to do good. And the purpose, and historically, it's been businessmen, clergy, people who come together, town or city, to just do good work and to be able to do service for good. Right. And that's really a very interesting thing, the history of the Malden Rotary Club. I was privileged enough to become their president during their 100-year anniversary. And it was a very, it was a privilege to be able to serve in that capacity and to assist in road races that were planned by them. But full disclosure, that they've been doing, you know, a lot of things like that long before I was a member, let alone a president.
Right. And you're also a town meeting member for the 14th Precinct in Arlington.
Yes. Right? Yes. Although I know in the town of Arlington, they would cringe to hear 14th. I got scolded one time. I said, oh, I'm from the 14th Precinct. And they're like, they're in the town of Arlington, they're very forthright. They'll just say, listen, that's incorrect. It's Precinct 14. And I'll be like, oh. I'm like, oh my.
Well, my apologies.
No, I mean, mutually, for both of us, you felt attacked. Yeah. I feel attacked for you. So it was so crazy. Yeah, it's.
Why the distinction? Why?
I have no idea. Okay. I think it's. I imagine they're gonna say it's based on some bylaw and it matches the state, and therefore it's best to just abide.
Right.
And yes, thank you for bringing that up. I am also a town meeting member in Arlington. Precinct 14, also known as the 14th precinct here. And I love that. And I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I do drop the just to
stir things up. See what lands.
You know, just, you know, raise some blood pressures. We'll see.
So what does that position entail?
So town meeting, the best way I can describe it, is like a Pilgrim's Congress. Our old towns in Massachusetts began when colonialists, Pilgrims, Puritans, a lot of that time, it matched a lot of what historically was church leadership, within them being a select board, usually men, where they would tend to the affairs of the church. And then this grew into colonies and then overall commonwealths. Towns still have this innate governmental structure where the select board is the executive authority of the town. They made it where it's representative, where each precinct gets 12. There are 21 precincts in Arlington, amounting to roughly 252 of us on any given year that are able to vote on articles. Warrant articles is just a fancy word for a little amendment or bylaw, something to change in the town.
Right. And how did you get involved in that? How did you come across being on this board and being part of that committee?
So the reason why I ran for town meeting was I had just moved to Arlington. What was interesting was walking around the town, I've always realized that a lot of the fun in doing any sort of organizing, civic, or what have you, is getting concrete things done that actually are beneficial to people. And I didn't really know how to go about doing that. I felt like I was getting activist fatigue. I was feeling as though that I in no way was equipped, let alone qualified, to actually be like an executive to lead on certain matters. I care a great deal about things and I serve on boards, but it's important to be able to say like, this is an aspect of service that I feel like is beneficial, is helpful, and it is appropriate in my participating in it.
Right. And this isn't your only time running for office either. Nope. You ran for a
school committee.
Yeah. Ward 1 school committee in Somerville in 2017.
I did.
And what do you learn from doing all these different campaigns and running for all these different offices? What did you learn about yourself and about politics?
Oh, that's a good question. What I learned about politics is that timing is everything. Timing and messaging. And there are aspects of control. Control of messaging discipline and how it is that how you self-perceive your candidacy differs from the actual race itself. Learning how other people engage the issues. And in return, you learn how to be a more active listener. And that's what I learned from my first school committee race in the city of Somerville. That was my first race ever. And it was very interesting because I had just became naturalized as a U.S. citizen just a few years earlier. So that race was really interesting because that was me trying to address at that time. Looking back, I'm like, wow, that young man. So at that time, I wanted to speak up for the immigrant population of East Somerville. I myself, being an immigrant, although being dissimilar because that area was predominantly Central American, high Brazilian population. I myself, being born in Paraguay, close to Brazil, shared history, but not the same, seeing that there was a language difference. So at that time, that was particularly unique because I was ill-suited for the role. I ran because I felt like I was able to help because I had more or less been volunteering with a group called the Welcome Project, and I've seen how they've been able to deal with the immigrant population in the Somerville public school system. And at that time, I felt that when there was an opening, that my bilingualism, my lived experience, and my overall work would allow me to make a dent and break through to be more representative to that ward in Somerville.
And you mentioned that you are an immigrant from Paraguay.
Yeah.
You're also pretty active in working with the Latinx population.
Mm-hmm.
So you were elected as the Boston chapter president for the Harvard Latino Alumni Alliance. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Damn, you got all my receipts.
What can I say?
Yes.
So I do my homework.
Yes.
So what, how, tell me about that. You were one of the founding members, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you come across that? What was that experience like? And what impact do you think it's had on the community?
In the Latino and or Latinx community in Harvard University was a very disconnected one. It was interesting. My experience is very dissimilar from a great many number of other university graduates because of the fact that I was a complete hippie. I don't know how to describe myself at 18. At 18, I thought I was going to be a filmmaker. I was going to go to the Manhattan School of Visual Arts. At some point, I realized I did not want to spend that much money. And I fleed. My uncle, who's also Paraguayan, was moving to Massachusetts. And he had recommended Harvard Extension School, which is their continuing education, night school, insert, adult education, what have you. At that time, 2008, there was a bit of a, let's just call it like a market kerfuffle. And for the most part, it looked like nothing institutional-wise was working.
You mean with the recession?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The 2008, 2009. It was a different time where I had graduated high school. And all my options were open, but it looked like everything was falling apart. So I viewed that nothing, at that point, it looked like nothing was permanent. Nothing I could begin would be permanent. It just seems like, okay, I'm going to just take these classes, get some undergraduate credits, get some work experience, see what's my next opportunity, whatever I can do. So I was very fortunate that I was able to do that. I am fortunate to even have had enough of the savings, enough of the ability to even do some of the work to even get in, let alone do the work. So I commend my high school for preparing me in that regard. But in short, my experience entering Harvard University by that way acclimated me to a great many number of Latino students that themselves were from the extension school, that themselves were from the college, graduate schools. And we had to find each other. And it was something where we all felt particularly lonely because I think in addition to the climate, there is just a culture clash that comes with the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant propriety and ethic, and what is a very, I think that it extends itself to culture, language, music, and the history of being able to be accessible and equitable to a great many number of students, Black, AAIP, AAPI, and Latin American, Latino, and Latinx students, because there was just a need to feel a sense of belonging and initiatives that supported our opportunity.
Right. And that's great. And when you ran for a school district and just overall, from what I've research and what I understand, your priorities seem to be with youth unemployment,
yes,
families facing affordability crises,
yes,
and translation services.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about why those issues in particular are so important to you with the array of social justice causes to choose from?
Yes. So going back to what I was previously saying, we were concerned about, not equality of outcome, but opportunity. And I see that when it comes to a lot of what I've been able to do, it's been a result of having, I would even say undeservedly, access to work in my youth. Whether that be allowing me to create my own savings, having cash on hand. I found that in many ways, it offers a sense of development, character, financial, and I believe that at that time when I was living in East Somerville, I had just done an effort here in the city of Malden, the Mayor's Summer Youth Employment Program, and I had just got done being a mentor to a bunch of kids in regards to developing workforce skills. And in return, it helped me out to improve my workforce skills as an adult. And I found that at the time, the city of Somerville did not have anything similar. So I felt that it was an opportunity to push them to reconsider areas that are appropriate for out of school time.
Wonderful. That's great to hear. And you mentioned being bilingual.
Yes.
English and Spanish?
Yes.
Yeah. And so how has that worked as a kind of a cultural bridge for you to work within the Latino community? And then also when you've been running for office and appealing to the large immigrant and Hispanic population that is in the greater Malden area?
Those are all really good questions. In East Somerville, that's when I was living there, that was the most, I could say, with the exception of my living in Chelsea for 1 year, the most, one of the most diverse places that I've lived. I now live in Arlington, and although it is itself diverse in its way, it does not match the diversity of Malden. It does not match the diversity of Somerville. So the way it is informed to me, despite the fact that I am very Eurocentrically presenting, I'm more Hamlin than Guillermo in my presence. But at the same time, Guillermo is a very common name in Spain, where you see people with blonde hair, blue eyes, and then you see Guillermo being a very popular name in all throughout Latin America, where it's the complete opposite. And I think that it lends itself to the history of Spanish conquest in Latin America and the fact that we gleefully compete about our Hispanidad just by nature of how more European we can be and these names and what have you. And I think that the story of Latin America is a lot like the United States. It's a story of immigration. It's a story of multi-generational, multiracial, and it in itself brought forth a very diverse and different culture that has in itself claims of ancestry, history, racism, everything that is just as messy as here in the United States.
Right. And with that language, within your use of language, it reminds me of in the book where, mm-hmm. How Trevor Noah is able to use these different tribal languages mm-hmm. as a way to bridge these divides and rise the social hierarchies. And you also mentioned your name being yes. a huge factor. And so in the book, it talks about how Trevor's name is both meaningful but also meaningless, which makes it inherently meaningful.
Exactly.
And so I'll read a quote from page 67. The name Zosa family gives their children always have a meaning, and that meaning has a way of becoming self-fulfilling. When it was time to pick my name, she chose Trevor, a name with no meaning whatsoever in South Africa, no precedent in the family. My mother wanted her child beholden to no fate. She wanted me to be free to go anywhere, to do anything, and be anyone. How do we see names tied to expectations in the global society?
In global society, it really depends, because migration is natural. So it ultimately depends on where your feet are at and what your name can do for you. In Paraguay and Latin America, I would be a Chad. Here, I'm Guillermo. And it's odd because it's my father's name that I share. And similar to Trevor, I have a brother named Isaac. And on top of that, there's the connection of the biblical middle name, because my name, my middle name is Samuel, after the prophet Samuel in the Bible. And similar to Trevor Noah and his relationship with his mother, there was a committed Christianity that informed a great deal about how I view my name, how I view the narrative and allegories behind it, and the expectations I imagined for myself at that time were subtly religious, although later in my life I've grown more non-theistic. But I would I wouldn't be forthcoming if I said that my long stretches, like Trevor Noah, in attending vast church services. I used to attend a lot of church service, like a ridiculous amount.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Trevor, his reading of the Bible comes from the multiple use of language. And with that comes different cultural understandings, which I think he uses to empathize with different perspectives, different groups, and to achieve a sense of balance.
Wonderful. And yeah, so you, how has the juxtaposition between your very traditionally Hispanic first name and your more WASPy last name kind of echoed the dialectic that we see with Trevor being biracial in South Africa?
Well, in the case of Trevor Noah being biracial in South Africa, he had the apartheid element to deal with. I would say I'm the reverse Trevor Noah.
What do you mean by that?
The fact that I'm like the perfect virus in the eyes of a white supremacist. I make WASP moves, but right. My name is Guillermo, and I have no real... I'm like really nobody, because I'm standing by my name and my work, my accomplishments, and in many other respects in the traditional stereotypical WASP idea is, who are you? Like, what? It's more so they refer to you by the last name as opposed to the strength of any first name or your culture, where you're from, your nation of origin. And I think that that's what informs me, is that he is always arriving while in a state of departure. He is learning different and engaging with people in different languages. His relationship with his father is a whole cultural shift in context. The same way that I myself, being raised in the United States, whenever I visited my home country, Paraguay, it really was in itself revealing in the fact that I saw how certain elements it's developed, like the United States, and other aspects it's not. Mm-hmm. And that's part of its fixed history. The fact that Paraguay is very, very mestizo. It's mixed with indigenous populations, European populations. There's a small African-American population there. And it's interesting that, like I was mentioning before, in the history of the United States, it's very similar in the history of Latin America, that you have these currents of different cultures that make up all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think that we are all dealing with a double consciousness of sort. In my case, it means moving to New England at 18, adapting, but retaining a lot of what made me, which is, you know, my upbringing, my family, who I love deeply, and being raised in Spanish-speaking spaces. And at times, those were brown Spanish-speaking spaces.
Thank you so much for sharing that. With the book, as you were reading it, and after you finished reading it, what messages, themes, scenes really stuck out to you and impacted the way that you live your life or think about certain things?
It reminded me of my childhood in some aspects.
In what ways?
There was a certain point where, thinking about on my childhood, it was the equivalent of looking at memories on Facebook or something, where I would see how incomplete and underdeveloped I was, and I would cringe, lament, and hate. What I love about this book is that he was able to really hold himself to account in the case of him, you know, taking, stealing stuff, burning illegal CDs and stuff. In the case of him looking at a, you know, camera device with a picture of a family in it. While I have never, like, stolen to that extent, I think my account remembers that, like, I think I was, like, 7 years old, I took a Nickelodeon magazine, and I felt terrible, and I brought it back, and I made a whole scene. But in the case, there were other aspects where he is very raw and honest about where he was, how it is that he decided to make his way, how he was challenged. And in a way, I felt that that was a very appropriate way to deal with the past. and despite how painful it was, he had all the makings for excuses in regards to the why and the how of his situation regarding the new stepfather, but just even beyond that, just his relation with the state in general. He had to go black market. He had to really hustle. He had to really do what was compelling for him to do to maintain a sense of security. And while I myself never felt compelled to do black market activity, I did feel a sense of dread when it came to the feds because I was an immigrant throughout my teenage life. When at that time, it's an area for development, learning about yourself and being as messy as you can be so that when you're an adult, you can be responsible and refined.
Yeah. And you talked about the stolen camera that he attempts to sell, and it kind of acts as a awakening for him in a way. It says page 215 on my guide, but I don't see it in the book, but that could just be me. So it talks about why we cause others pain. And he says, we live in a world where we don't see the ramifications of what we do to others because we don't live with them. If we could see one another's pain and empathize with one another, it would never be worth it for us to commit the crimes in the first place. And within your work in politics, how do you see this play out? What role does empathy play? And how, I mean, people talk about like treat these kids at the border like they were your kids, you know? And how these, what's his name, Dick Cheney, being so against gay rights until he has this gay daughter, and then he has to excuse himself from the gay marriage discussion. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, with these examples and with your work in politics, how do we see a unity between us all going under the commonality of being human and a division with all these different factors and prejudices that come in? Does that make sense? It's a pretty loaded question.
It's loaded, but I'll try to unpack there. I'll swim in that. I think that I have to start accepting that the work I'm doing is politics. I think that's something I have to accept because I like to think of it as government in relation to the stuff I do outside of UMA. But in reality, when it comes to the politics of, say, town government, city government, it depends ultimately on what can you ultimately serve? How can you serve to your precinct in the case of what I do? Although I'm not limited just to my precinct, it's just my precinct that elects me. How are you going to actually materially and beneficially serve your constituents? And the biggest thing that I can find regarding empathy is that it's helped me in regards to getting elected to town meeting, in allowing me to learn after my first loss in running for school committee in 2017. It made me realize that if you're talking more about your campaign as opposed to what the constituents are willing to share, then I believe that, again, as I mentioned earlier, it contributes to a humbling that then begins to develop the muscle of active listening.
And if you were omnipotent within the government, very high ranking, like president or something, but with the ability to just kind of pass legislation, what concrete actions would you take to increase trust and empathy and general relations between the government and the citizenry?
I really don't know.
Okay, that's fine.
The thing that I can definitely...
Well, you talked about your issues with being afraid of the feds and things like that. And so, like, how could that have been improved, you know?
There's nothing you could tell that teenage Paraguayan immigrant living in New Jersey. Right. There's nothing I could have told him to say, don't fear them. Just keep doing the work that you're doing. I had a very irrational fear. And it was because of the fact that I had not grown up. A lot of my impressions were that I saw on like HBO. I was watching The Sopranos. And in some twisted way, I was tying my fate as an immigrant to these mobsters, which is very foolish. It shows you how impressionable teenagers can be. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that I can describe, most recently, last night, I was serving on town meeting with myself and my colleagues. And we had and one of the most recent things that we wanted to work on and adopt was a domestic partnership bylaw. And that came as a result of some work with Rainbow Arlington and other people, because we wanted to help our residents to just have simple rights to confer visitation, specifying of your partner, school pickup visitation, all those things, the stuff of life. That's very private, but in a way you have to reveal a little bit about yourself to just get going and to be a part of the town and provide the town services and what have you. So myself and other colleagues, we pushed forward this domestic partnership bylaw in the city of Somerville and Cambridge. They recently made it plural, where you can have more than one, like basically plural partnerships, polyamorous and stuff of that nature. And we were thinking, well, we don't want to get outdone. We don't want to be excluding a great many number of people who identify as such. But this is where government politics and empathy come at play, is that with politics, because of how limited it is, it can only go as far as the law can allow it. The law will demand of you something that's not ideal. Last night we passed a domestic partnership bylaw that recognizes two or more, but at the same time, we don't confer any ability or power to give them group health insurance rights or anything of that nature. We're not giving them much, just that we're dignifying them when they're out in the park, that we're dignifying them if they're picking up their kid at school, if them and their polycule want to get a vaccine test or a vaccine administered at the local health and human service or at the local gym. It's very micro, very small. And for those of us who are wish it were more, I think of aspects like, I don't know if you've seen, there's been a book, but also a movie, Professor Marston and in Wonder Woman. It talked about how the creator of Wonder Woman effectively was in a polyamorous household. And I'm thinking, well, maybe this is not enough for myself and my other colleagues, because we wanted to do so much more. We wanted to remove the residence requirement. We wanted it to be more accessible to people. But we're limited by the scope of what we're able to accomplish. And I think that with a lot of things, a lot of the big issues that I more so care about, this domestic partnership thing was a really good civil rights win for the town of Arlington. But at the same time, it's very frustrating seeing how these other limitations find themselves in other more important aspects, such as housing, jobs, especially in dealing with youth unemployment.
Yeah. So why the move to America? How old were you when you moved?
I was an infant. And why the move to America? That's a really good question. I believe, if you ask my mom, it had to do with like family. I had grandparents that moved here, I believe in the 80s, to like Brooklyn. I think Coney Island was their first residence or so. And then little by little, you know, her brothers, her sisters will start making their way over to the United States. And it was a slow but sure thing, this migration, one by one. I've never really asked my mom this, but when I Googled and when I really did my research about that time, the country of Paraguay was going through what I would like to very jokingly call a transition. They had a dictator, roughly, like a German-esque dictator, because there is a German population in Paraguay. And what's interesting is that at that time, I was born in 1989. And prior to that, leading up to 89, there was a military intervention, like military generals basically ousted an existing dictator. Now, luckily, I was an infant and I had no idea this happened. Zero, none. Again, I'm the anti-Trevor Noah. And so it was interesting just because given everything that was outlined, I don't know if my mom is like, if it was because of that, but it's very clear to say that the country was in transition and there was more opportunity in the United States of America. Her parents were here. Her brothers and sisters were here. And so came we.
Yeah. It makes me think about in the book when Trevor Noah talks about, in the book when he talks about how when he does meet other mixed race kids from South Africa, they always left. And that was the main difference. They grew up somewhere else. And it's just, it's interesting to hear, like, and to think about how his entire life would have been changed. How his, I mean, he's such a huge celebrity now. And that came a lot from his roots.
There's a lot of things here that even his, again, the his relationship with the church, hyper-Christianity, it all goes to inform how media is visual literacy. And he does a really good job telling jokes and conveying a sense of understanding using media as visual literacy.
Yeah. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Let's give it up for Guillermo Hamlin. Seriously, this was great. Thank you so much. Everyone, this has been Guillermo Hamlin. I'm Annie Bennett, your host. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
For 11 years, Malden Reads has been exploring the answer to the question, what if all of Malden read the same book? You can check them out at maldenreads.org. That's maldenreads.org. And follow them on social media. And while you're there, check out the personal greeting to Malden from Trevor Noah on the set of The Daily Show.